it's on now.
Right. I mean, nothing turns on it, so you can just edit out anything you don't want.
Yes.
It doesn't if it's got to be broadcast.
No, but yeah. I'll give you a copy of, you know, as before.
Okay,
you
know. Fine.
I really wonder, could we start off where we started before,
yes.
Namely parents?
Yeah.
Her father, could you say who her father was?
Yes, her father was William L. Chubb, who was a general practitioner in Kent, Sandgate in Kent, and Farnborough in Hampshire. A splendid chap, a benign man, and her mother, forgotten her name, very nice, died in 1927.
Yeah.
When my mama was 34.
Was her mother an important influence, actually, at all? Were either of them an important influence?
Oh, I'm sure they were, in a background way, and it'd be very difficult for me to say how much they were, because, well, for obvious reasons. I would guess that having sent her to Oxford in, what must that have been, 1911 or 12,
yes.
Was a fairly imaginative thing to have done. Because at that time, there weren't many women going to universities. Well, you'll know if I'm right about that, but I think so. I think that was definitely a rather liberal, progressive thing to have done. So I only heard her speak entirely favourably of both her parents, so I think probably that they provided a very happy, stable home. They lost a brother. Her brother, Alan, was killed in the First War, and that must have been a jolt, obviously, for them. But apart from that, I think it was a thoroughly happy home.
Was it a joke for her, actually? I hadn't realised she had a brother.
Yes. I don't know. I think he wasn't very bright, and I think there was some problem about what career he was going to follow. So that, perhaps that doesn't subtract from the jolt at all, but I think there probably was a slight background of non-satisfaction. But that's all I can say. I'm sure it must have been a jolt to them all. There was a sister too, Mary,
yes.
Who died.
Younger
a younger sister, who was 3 years younger and died in 72, when she was 76. She was a pain in the neck.
She really?
A frightful boy. I always used to say that it was very hard luck. The Almighty had divided the talents 99-1 between those two girls, but she's quite unimportant. Except just this, although this is a trivial personal thing, that her sister Mary was the only person I ever heard who could get my mama worried and irritable, really quite angry, in about 15 seconds from a standing start. Because when she would, out of duty, ring her up when she came up to London, I would often be in the room, and you could hear her voice going hard and getting sort of, you know, rather contrivedly patient, when in fact she was feeling very impatient with her sister, who was a querulous, self-pitying person who was actually quite able, quite good-looking in a way, made the worst of herself, spent her life complaining.
What did she do?
She was for about 30 or 40 years secretary of the Barristers' Benevolent Association, didn't go to university, and was very able. And if you asked, well, they'd mostly be dead now, a lot of judges and senior QCs a few years ago, they'd have the highest opinion of her. She obviously ran it awfully well. But as a person was...
Very few people could irritate your mother, is my impression, so she must have been pretty exhausting.
That impression, absolutely. Well, she was exhausting, but of course the reason why she irritated her more quickly than anybody else was that my mama felt, in a sense, responsible for her. She'd never married, had looked after her father till he died in 37, and so that... she felt she had to ring up pretty well every night, I think, when she was in London. Whereas other people just found her a bore, she found
yes.
her much more than that.
Mm.
And I'm sure that Mary behaved towards my mama in a much more, probably emotionally demanding way than she'd behaved towards anybody else. But after my mama died, I went to see Mary every Saturday pretty well. And it really was a very dreary experience. I used to... I'll let it wash over me. So she was.
That all sets sort of background. But
yeah.
Was your mother the eldest child then, or the second child?
I can't say. I'm pretty sure she was the eldest. And
yes.
Let me get started. She was born in 1893, Mary in 1896. Alan was killed about 1915. Isn't it awful? I don't know. I'm afraid I can't remember where Alan
yes.
came.
Mm. And
maybe between them.
And her mother died in, did you say, 1927?
Yeah.
And her father?
In 1937. He was aged about 81, I think, then.
Mother How was did she cope with that, then? Was she wasn't responsible for looking after him, then the sister was
responsible. No, that's right. They lived, Mary, the sister, and William, father, grandfather, my grandfather, lived together in Pitt Street, and he had coronary disease and died there. He'd had a coronary before, and having lived down the country, which he loved, gardening and so on, had had to give that up, come up to London, then had another coronary, and died fairly quickly, I think.
Was he proud of your mother, do you think? I mean,
I would guess so, without being quite sure.
Yes. Anyway, and her father was what, exactly, in Kent?
General practitioner?
Family doctor,
yeah.
And just stayed that all the way.
Yes. Which, in those days, and to a certain extent, still most family doctors would expect to stay at all of
that. Yes, but that means she's in on the medical world, really, from the start.
Yes, that's true. I would have doubted if that was a significant factor.
Yes.
Because, you see, she left home to go to Oxford, and so after the age of 18 was really hardly at home. And I shouldn't have thought that played much part in any later decisions.
Mm. Then, moving on then from parents, a happy childhood is your impression then?
Very. She loved school. I know that. Kanema, which she was at from... I think there was a gap from, say, 6 or 7 until she went to Oxford at 18. She was there for a long time. Loved that.
Could you just spell that?
C-O-N-A-M-U-R, Kanema.
And that's now deceased.
And that's, up a long time ago. Yes. Long time ago, I mean.
A private paying school for girls.
That's really. Right, yeah. And from age 6 or 7 until 18.
And she was happy, presumably because of games, primarily.
I think she was happy because she was a person who was given half chance would always be happy. Just as her sister Mary made the worst of everything, including herself, my mama made the best of everything. And she was good-looking, popular, good at games, very friendly. And I think school was mother's milk to her. And you see, I think she was a day girl, if I remember correctly, because it was... I think she was a day girl on her first stage because Kanema was in Folkestone, which is very near Sandgate. And then I think when they moved to, I may be wrong about this, when they moved to Farnborough in Hampshire, she probably went back there as a boarder. I'm not quite sure.
So she really starts off, in a sense, with the most important advantages, namely a feeling of security and
I would think so, yes.
Happiness.
Yeah.
Anyway, she then went to Oxford, got a second in history, didn't
right,
she?
Right, yeah.
Was Oxford an important influence on her, do you think, or Somerville an important influence?
Again, it's awfully difficult for me to be sure. I mean, I would guess it was. I think she had a marvellous time there. I think she made quite a lot of friends whom she kept for life. And I know several people whom she used to refer to as my old coal pal, and these would be people who were, some of them, still alive. Helen Derbyshire, wasn't she the mistress?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, she and Vera Farnell, I think...
Yes.
Vera Farnell was a contemporary of hers, I think, at Oxford.
Yes,
Miss Derbyshire would be a good deal older, wouldn't she?
I think so. And Mrs. Frankenberg was, I think, one year older or something.
Was she?
Because she didn't know her anyway.
Yes,
I think.
Yes.
Anyway, I think we discussed this last time, didn't we? Whether, in fact, you know, you feel your way through life partly with the aid of the friends you make at university.
Mm.
You feel there was something in that with her, do you? Though not so much career, but simply finding these people pleasant.
I think that's what it is. I think she got on easily with people. That was a time of life when she was very happy and enjoyed very much. And I think she just naturally picked up these friends and stayed friends with several of them. I don't know how many she dropped away from.
Yes. So where when does she meet her husband then?
Well, she went down from Oxford and went into the WACS, that is the Women's Army
Corps.
Or something like that. That's right. Yes, that's WAAAC. And she was concerned with recruiting there and worked in the War Office and met my pa, who... had a certain amount of fame there because he'd escaped from Germany, which very, very few people did. Having been interned in Berlin, he walked across Germany with somebody else and got out to Holland. And perhaps it was through that, I don't know. That must have been 1915. I think they were married in 1917 or 18. I'm afraid, remember how they first met, but maybe after he'd escaped from Germany.
And
while she was still in the WACS, I think.
He was an interesting man, you say.
Yes, I mean, he was. A very unusual chap.
Yes, I'm so, as an educationist, primarily, is that his main interest, or is he...
I don't think that would be quite fair, and I think it's very difficult to describe in what way he was interested. I think he was interesting as a man of original ideas, which sounds an odd way of putting it, but he was certainly a very original man, and I think you have to remember that in those days, we're talking about the First World War times, soon afterwards, real originality of thought was much less common than it has since become, and after all, this time Bernard Shaw's plays were having an impact, which now, of course, they wouldn't have at all. And so I think that perhaps his originality stood out more then than it would do now. And I don't think it was special in relation to education, although I suppose in a sense that was his main drive. I think it sounds arrogant, it doesn't matter. I think perhaps having a son for him focused his interest on how to bring up children. I guess he had strong ideas
as
about four.
Bertrand Russell, actually. As well.
Really? Yes. Mm. Well, maybe that was what turned it. And he went into the city, he raised a lot of money, went bankrupt later, but had raised a lot of money to pay for the Waltinghouse School.
The Waltinghouse School, this was at Cambridge.
This was a school at Cambridge from 1923 or 4 until 1928, that's right, which was really was created for me, but it was just an experiment in education.
So he had friends in, did he, to, as well, to contribute their children, so to speak, as Bertrand Russell did, and I mean, it became a small sort of...
I don't think it was friends. I think he started in Cambridge because he thought that would be a good place to, for such an adventurous school to be, and it'd be well received there than elsewhere, which he subsequently thought he was probably wrong in assuming. And I think it was open to anybody in Cambridge to send their children there, not particularly his friends, although some of them became so.
And it folded up because he went bankrupt.
He went bankrupt, yes. I said 28, I think it was 29.
What was your mother's role in the school?
I would have guessed she was the oil that oiled the wheels, because I think there were... He was away a lot in the city making money. It could be difficult, certainly, to get on with. He had some fairly hectic financial times, and she all the time, I think, had to act as the person who saw that everything was all right. I mean, he wasn't a particularly practical chap. I'm sure she had to see that the school just operated smoothly and that parents were looked after, were received, and so forth, and generally be a benign and stabilizing and efficiency-provoking influence around all the time.
She didn't actually teach herself, then.
I don't think so, as far as I remember,
She sort of was really the administrator, in a way.
Well, in a sense, as far as was one, and also a sort of background mother to a lot of children, I should think.
Mm. Mm. How big, actually, was it?
I don't believe it ever had more than, say, 20 to 24 children there at any one time.
Yeah.
If you actually wanted to find that out, I think Susan Isaacs's books would be pretty sure.
Yes, well,
also with that article, Experiment in Education.
Yes, I shall certainly. Yeah. So that really gets her, in a sense, I suppose, launched in practical affairs, rather, doesn't it? I mean, if you...
Well, I think the wax must have taught her a lot about running a show.
Mm. It must have developed her abilities quite a lot.
Absolutely, and in an unexpected way. I mean, she had difficult times, I'm sure. I mean, there were times when people came whom my pa did not want to see for financial reasons, and she had said, you know, he's out or ill or something. So I think she had a fairly rough time.
Your father was away in the city making money. That is simply raising money for the school, is it?
No, well, raising it, but in the sense that he had companies which were buying and selling things in the city, and in the end, yes. In the end, they ganged up on him. I mean, I think he was, I don't understand this, but I think he was buying and selling on forward dates or narrow margins. And anyhow, he did a risky thing and it all collapsed.
So primarily, he was a businessman.
No, that wouldn't be right either. No, the whole purpose of raising money was for the school, not at all for himself, absolutely not. So the businessman would be really... grotesquely wrong.
Merely mean.
Absolutely. Yes. But, I mean, it would conjure up the reverse of the truth.
Yes.
I think he was Jewish, and I think he had a sort of, not that he was sort of conscious of that, but he had, I think, the sort of Jewish contempt, if you like, for other people. Oh, money-making must be easy. You know, you see people, stupid men who go up the city every day, who buy and sell things and seem to come back very rich. I know I'm brighter than that. I can do it better. And I think other people have had the same feeling, and they're often right, but I think probably their overconfidence induces them to take risks which are dangerous and caught up with him in the end.
Yes, I see. You were born in 1921, I think.
Yeah,
weren't
that's
you?
Right.
So
yeah.
Your mother was,
she was 28 when I was born.
Yes, your earliest years were in the school, but...
the school actually didn't start till, I can't remember, 23 or 24.
I see.
24, yeah. I think.
So you were only born in London for a year or so, presumably, and then it all...
No, 24 to 28. 24 to 29, I'm sorry. Mm. I was in school from when I was age 3, I think, until 8 when it filled. So I was there the whole time.
Yes.
And that was, I think, 5 years.
Yes. So anyway, the school broke up and your parents' marriage broke up.
Yes.
I didn't ask you last time, you may not want to comment on this, but do you think that her own experience of marriage is at all relevant to her later career? I mean, you may not...
Mm. I think the only honest answer is I don't know.
Mm.
I have no idea.
I mean, she didn't sort of develop unusual or pronounced views about the family or divorce or...
They never were divorced, actually. Neither of them ever wanted, I think, to get married again. I think it just wasn't worth doing so.
Mm.
It's
an obvious sort of immediate thing... conclusion to draw or hypothesis,
yes.
Isn't it?
But I think it would be wrong. I mean, I can't say that it may not have, as it were, set the background scene for what she later did, but my very strong guess would be that it wasn't a bit like that, that because her marriage had broken up and because my pa had gone bankrupt and was anyhow not very reliable in terms of ordinary arrangements of money, she had to earn the money. I know her father helped her, but it wasn't enough. She had a son, after all, and she wanted to educate me, and I sent me to boarding school. So she had to earn money. And I think that was the spur, very much so. And the first year, from 1929 to 30, she was secretary of Hayes Court School, you see. And
yes.
Now this was done because I'm sure it was a congenial job, but she never went into that because she wanted, as it were, to go into education. And I think that she went in the following year to National Birth Control. Council. That's right.
Yeah.
Because she was interested in birth control. I think in both cases it was a congenial, interesting job, and she had to have a job. I wouldn't have said it was anything more than that.
Yes, that's very interesting, because, I mean, you can just imagine what historians might be deducing.
Yes, truth other than God. But, I mean, I just don't think that that would be a fair interpretation as far as I know.
Mm. This Hayes Court School, where is that exactly?
That's in Hayes, which is sort of southeast corner of London, where the Electricians Union now have their headquarters, I think.
Mm. HAYES.
Correct, yes. It's on the way out towards Biggin Hill, that way.
I can drive past it twice a week.
Very lovely place it was.
She was really doing in that school what she had already done in your father's
school. Well, in a much more formal sense, because in my father's school, Malthinghouse School, she'd been the wife of the chap who ran it, the mother of the one child in the school, and it was a much more nebulous, but I think probably more pervasive influence there than at Hayes Court, where she was the school secretary, doing what an ordinary school secretary does. I would guess that it was fortuitous that the job, that you could look at the job as being in any way similar to the one she did at the Malthinghouse. I think she probably got it through Miss Cox. I'm not very sure about this. I could find out if you wanted to know. I think it was a Cambridge friend whose sister was head of the school. I can't remember,
I
think it was a personal connection.
Yes,
she got that
yes.
job.
So why does she move on to the FBA? Is it later? Is it just money, more money?
I don't know, I'm afraid. Now, that school you see packed up, it may, it's a fairly small private school, it may have packed up then. Or she may have been attracted by the other job. I could probably find out from old friends who are still alive who would know that, if you wanted to know.
Well, it doesn't...
I doubt if it's a terribly important motive either way, actually.
Yes.
My recollection is it may have been Hayes Court packed up.
It is rather...
She'd have known that nothing pleases me more than talking about her.
she had a sense of humour, actually.
Oh,
presumably.
Yes,
I mean,
oh, yes, no question.
Quite a good
Oh, tremendous. Oh, yes. You were asking about this job business. I think,
that's right.
I think it would be fair to say probably that she took these jobs for purely practical reasons, but I'm sure that she couldn't have taken a job except temporarily and for desperate need for money, that was not congenial. I think she felt it had to be something, well, breathily, something socially useful. And I think it's something that would engage her enthusiasm, not just her duty.
So there's that limit that, you know, obviously in a sense, it must be something that she approves of, that she's
yes.
doing, but nonetheless there are a number of things she could have approved
yes.
of, and that was just the
yes.
one that came up.
Well, I mean, to jump ahead, you see, in the war when the FPA virtually didn't function, she, because Lady Denman was head of the Land Army, as it were, created this job of editor of the Land Girl, which was their journal, which she did without payment, and put her back into that in just the same way she'd have put into the job. Well, I mean, that again was a valuable job, but it was...
Yes, yes. And in general, I think you think, don't you, that she's not a woman of causes, so to speak.
That's right, yeah.
At all.
I think she's a... Blake doing good by minute particulars. Well, that's perhaps overstating it, but I think she very much cared about life of her own and other people's. Very much a sympathetic person who, if she saw something not being properly done or somebody in trouble, would automatically move in to help if she could. Not in any officious way, but you know, any friends who were ill or in trouble, she would just do the sensible, practical things almost instinctively. So I think she felt a bit the same about the job. I don't believe she could have done I doubt if she could even have done the job her sister did, the Barristers' Benevolent Association, although she might for a bit. I think she probably had to have something that engaged her sense of purpose, as well as just enthusiasm, and I'm sure the FPA very quickly came to do that. But
yes, I mean,
it was that way round, I think.
Yes, and she doesn't start off at all particularly, though of course you couldn't say from direct observation, as a feminist, but she, in a sense she becomes a sort of feminist.
Yes.
I think we discussed the relationship, you know, between the birth control movement and the feminist movement, and
yes.
they overlap, but they're not identical, and
She certainly wasn't a chain-to-the-railings type at all.
Mm.
I don't know what her attitude was to Pankhurst. I think they're interested and sympathetic, but not of that school. And I would have thought that supposing her cause, she'd given herself to something to do with education, that could just as well have been
yeah.
it, when there was no sort of
yeah.
feminist component to it.
And as I think you agreed with Dr. Wright, didn't you, that her, in a sense, her motivation is humanitarian, apart from the financial motive, of course,
yeah, yeah.
Rather than feminist.
I would have thought very much so, mm. yes, yes.
Mm.
Practical and humanitarian.
Could you sort of sound off again
yes.
about Mary Stopes and, you know,
yes.
your what very interesting things you were saying about the different type of leader that birth control needed. Getting on with, I mean, you really felt that Mary Stopes was the right
yes,
person
at
right. the first stage.
Well, I think there were two phases in this whole work. The first of all were the Margaret Sangers, well, Margaret Sanger in America, who actually, I think, was a much more congenial person, really, than Mary Stopes, or at least much less mad and much easier to get on with. I did meet Margaret Sanger, knew her a little bit, and I only met Mary Stopes once, I think. But anyhow, these were people of really terrific courage and enterprise who were doing something which at that time involved, well, more or less the threat of physical violence sometimes, and prison and so forth. Certainly, I think Margaret Stopes either went to prison or... Margaret Sanger either went to prison.
Yes,
I think
did.
She did.
She
well,
came
that,
over
yes.
here to get away.
That's right. I mean, there really was a lot of physical courage needed, and you were abused and so forth. And I think, therefore, that the people who were prepared to do that had to be people who were absolutely seized of the importance of what they were doing and were very tough and courageous. And almost by definition, that means that it isn't a sort of ordinary, sensible, level-headed person. And I very much doubt whether my mama would ever have played that role. I mean, I know that I would never play that role. And I think it's merciful that some people do. Anyhow, that phase having been really accomplished, and you may say it's a bit early to say it was accomplished in about 1930, but it really that was about the time the nut had really been cracked. I think what was needed was people who could run an organization, which is jolly difficult to run, no money and silence as far as the newspapers and so forth went, keep everybody together, get doctors interested, there weren't very many, and certainly not top brass doctors, and really run a very smooth organisation in a very rough sea. And I think my mother was absolutely perfect for that, and would not have been perfect the first phase. And the thing that's always impressed me so much with two things. One is that the right pioneers were there at the right time, and not only Murray Stopes, by a long shot. I mean, who was it, Northcote? Mrs. Spring Rice, for example, who again, you know, tough as nails and tremendous courage and determination, and a few doctors, well, you'll know them, anyhow, the ones in the 1920s, some of whom sailed on into the later movement. That was one remarkable thing, that the pioneers were there, and then that they merged into the landscape of level-headed, sensible, practical people who didn't make difficulties but diminished them. And they, a few of them got out, like Murray Stopes, who was, I think, impossible to work with, probably, in any organisation that she didn't personally dominate. And it was that sort of driving arrogance which made her the force she was. You would know much better than I how influential she was as compared with some of these other people. Maybe her part was overplayed. I mean, it was her book which really hit the headlines in all senses. That's one remarkable thing. And I think the second astonishing thing is that throughout the whole history of the FPA, roughly, no branch closed or seceded. That isn't quite true. I mean, Cambridge did and so on, but it's all but true. Even when the FPA at the end was, whatever it was, 900 branches, the loss had been about zero through closure or secession. And I think it's remarkable.
And it's a history of amalgamation rather than fission.
Well, it was amalgamation to begin with, but then it was a question of reproduction.
Yes.
I mean, there were only, I think, you'd know, 8, 10 branches.
Something like that when it started.
In 1930, and it got to 900. And so that they were, when after the war, Margaret Howard and I was the organization secretary, they were starting a new branch every fortnight. Now, starting a branch of a volunteer committee with doctors who about the time came to be paid, professional rates, nurses, a clinic place to find, things to be cleared up every week, equipment to be bought, services to be advertised, still under some difficulty, even if the difficulty of it being ignored. I mean, you can understand how people would have just been deterred by the problems and folded up.
Yes. And the qualities required are, well, of course, they're combined by Lady Denman and your mother, aren't they?
Yes, as far as the central organisation goes, yes, I think that's right. Because Lady Denman was rich, very rich, had a lot of rich friends, was respectable, although a liberal, and in the pre-First World War days, that wasn't entirely respectable. And had very good connections, and so that she conferred respectability with that limit and financial support, which I'm sure was crucial for years, in fact, perhaps the rest of her life. And my mama provided, she provided the malting house, I would say, the oil and the machinery. So it just ran smoothly, but perhaps she provided a good deal more than that, actually. I mean, she got people in, she got branches going, and she really produced a lot of initiative. If we just say oil and the machinery, it implied she did nothing more than, as it were, I do here, just making sure that things mesh smoothly. She did much more than that, more than that.
And in combination with Lady Denman, they're a powerful team, really.
I would say very powerful, yes, very powerful. And with some of the doctors, you know, those pioneering doctors were almost all women,
yes.
were super. Difficult to deal with.
Could we sort of move towards the sort of qualities your mother brought to the FPA via what you saw in her as a mother in a one-parent family?
I mean,
you presumably saw that she was good at organising things, did you, as a mother?
Yes. You know, one sees that now, but when you're a child of 8, 10, 12, you don't go around thinking my mother's a good organiser. You just say, I want to get that cricket match. Or I've got to go back to school, or I'm going to a new school next term. And it doesn't occur to you that in order that these things should happen, somebody, which means your mother, has had to raise the money, has had to enter you for school, has had to make the arrangements, has had to get you taken to a cricket match or taken back to school when she was going to a conference or something like that. Everyone just accepts it, that that's what happens.
And it just went so smoothly, precisely you didn't realise it at the time.
That's right. I think it's asking more than is reasonable to expect a young child to realise what sort of effort has gone. I think one of the great things she did was that she did run my life so smoothly. I didn't realize.
Mm.
And I think how difficult it's to run my own family with two parents.
Of course, yes, 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 I quite understand. But in the house itself, was she well organized? Do you think in retrospect?
Very well organized. Very well organized, yes. And always was. I mean, the place would be neat and clean, and letters would be answered, things that needed doing would be listed and would be done. This never became a dominating obsession at all. It's just that I think that you realized that you actually were more efficient, could get things done more easily, and therefore accomplish more, both in terms of practical affairs and in terms of personal pleasure, if you were punctual and organized yourself. And I entirely agree with that.
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying you think that there was never really any conflict much between her role as a mother and her public role, really, that she organized things so well that never felt in any sense deprived.
I certainly never felt neglected at all. I mean, she, as I was saying last time, happily for her, I had some interest, like watching first-class cricket, so that she could pack me off to the Oval or Lords while she did a day's work. And then I would have friends stay and go and stay with them. So I think it was probably fairly easy for her to organise me. I did spend half my holidays with my father, you see, separately.
Oh,
so,
did you?
So I wasn't
I see. And you went to boarding school, did you?
I went to boarding school from the time Malting House stopped in 1929.
Yes, I see, yes. Did she actually have, she presumably had progressive, in inverted commas, ideas about education, did she?
I would have said, yes, I would have called them liberal and tolerant rather than progressive, which rather implies that somebody has a coherent set of ideas which are in advance of most current thinking. I think that would be too overstated. I mean, the school, I went to a little school in Norfolk for a year and then went to the Dragon School at Oxford, which is a splendid school, but you wouldn't have said it was a progressive school.
Well, I don't know.
Would you?
In some ways.
Well, okay, maybe, but I mean, it was certainly not unconventional. I mean, there were 350 little boys there who were all going to rugby and Marlborough, so you couldn't have called that unconventional.
Mm, no.
I think she made that
extremely
choice.
Extremely good school.
Yeah, that's right, But I mean, that was. That's a different point. Mm.
But from the point of view of her house, was she fastidious about where she lived and what was in it?
Well, you see, let me think. We lived in a flat in Albert Bridge Road in the early 30s, then in Sloane Square, and she shared these flats, because I don't think she could afford them alone, I was only there on holidays, with two others. She shared the Albert Bridge Road flat with two others, Kathleen Doman and Miss Isabel Jarvis, and then the flat in Wilburn Place near Sloane Square she shared with Kathleen Doman. And certainly those places were kept very...
So what does that mean? It means separate sort of bedrooms, but common kitchen...
that's right, yes.
And so that, in a sense, the burden of the housekeeping shared a bit between...
I think it was probably shared. I really don't know. Yes, they certainly seemed to be well-run as far as I could judge. You know, I had a room there and it was all...
It sounds as if she organised things very well.
I think she just was... That's right. She was a natural organiser without being the least bit bossy. At least I don't think she was bossy.
Yes.
I mean, you might get different opinions from other people.
And she was good with paperwork as well, was she?
Yes,
I mean,
I was
what you saw.
Excellent, as far as I could judge. Excellent. Yes. I mean, would answer letters, would answer them very clearly, would answer them very promptly, would have a filing system, and would have very good memory, and would know what was going on.
And good with money, because she had to be, really.
Yes, and that's right.
She had a flair for it.
Yes. I don't know that she would say she had a flair for money. I mean, that might be true. I don't think so, especially.
Mm.
I would have said that she was had a good sense of value and being orderly didn't waste it, but I don't think it specially interested her, actually.
Anyway, we're off now. I mean, she shows a sort of businesslike ability, she's well organised, she looks nice.
She dressed well,
as I think I remember you saying, well, sensibly, but not...
Certainly not flamboyantly, certainly not. For sure, I mean, she liked to look nice, I'm sure, and always did, and was very, I think it'd be fair to say, very elegant. I'm no judge of women's dress, but certainly she would always be well turned out and would never be scruffy, ever. But I don't think had special expensive tastes, as far as I know, and wouldn't certainly have no vanity in the sense of wanting to buy shoes or coats or hat or whatever, because it was made by some national. That would be certainly not.
But also not...
But liking, but not wanting to be shabby. You see, a lot of these women, like Mary Stocks, for example, had absolutely no sense of their own appearance. She's dead now. I'm sure she wouldn't. She wouldn't mind my thinking.
No,
you know that lovely story.
In it,
yes, you know that. I think I have to that gorgeous story when she was being attacked in, I think it was in Manchester, by the local bishop.
Yeah.
These painted ladies, they said, flaunting cigarettes. No, these overdressed ladies, I think, was flaunting cigarettes before their painted lips. And I think she had this stuck up on the wall because it cheered her up so much to think that she overdressed
and
painted.
And anything more inaccurate could hardly be.
Precisely,
imagined.
Precisely. So
your mother was not like that.
She was not like that. No, definitely not. I mean, some of these women were a bit mannish, I think. Mm. And she wasn't, certainly, absolutely not.
And she was also a fit person, so
yes.
That helped, presumably,
yes.
as well.
Yes.
I mean, did she
full
take exercise all her life, really? Quite, I mean, more than most people do?
I don't know about more, but she played quite a bit of tennis. She enjoyed hockey when she was younger. I think she probably gave that up, I should think, when we left Cambridge. But she played for Cambridgeshire, I think, while we were there. And she played a lot of golf later and enjoyed that. I think she wasn't, as it were, an addict of exercise, but she liked games very much.
And she had good health, really, always.
Yes. Well, this isn't quite true, no. In 1933 or so, she got primary tuberculosis and went to Midhurst. Sorry, I forgot to tell you that. Well, perhaps not. Anyhow, she did, and was in there for several months. And in those days, of course, there was no chemotherapy, and she had phrenic crush and pneumothorax, which is a bit of a bore, you know, weekly refills and so forth. And she was in there for several months. And then from that, when she came out of there, she went to live with Lady Denman at Balcombe. Although we must have kept on that flat at Wilburn Place after that. And we gave that up during the war, I think. So although she was living at Balcombe, she also had the flat in London.
And she actually lived with Lady Denman for the rest of her life? Lady Denman's life.
Yes, that's right. In effect, that's right. Yes.
What, having a room in her house or what, really?
Yes, I mean, Lady Denman lived at Balcombe Place, which has, I don't know, 30 bedrooms or something. Great big place, lovely house. And she had a large bedroom there. One of the rooms there just was hers. And so after, I suppose, 34, 5, in effect, she lived there. Yes.
Can you just say briefly what you feel drew them together? I mean, what they had in common?
I don't really know. Well, they certainly were very good friends. I think that probably they just generally had the same attitude to life, I think. I said Lady Denman's attitude was very similar. She'd had an unhappy marriage which had been virtually arranged by her mother. That was Lord Cowdrey, you see, the first Lord Cowdrey, who was, I mean, I think his grandson is still the richest man in England, or something, was her father, and I think was all right. Her mother was very ambitious. I think they'd arranged this marriage when she was only 19 to Lord Denman, who was a liberal peer and up-and-coming, who was really rather boring and pompous, to be honest. And at that time, apparently, was intolerably vain, and especially when they went out to be Governor General of Australia, that made him much worse, because here you were sent out because you happened to be one of the few Liberal lords at the time Liberals were in power, 1911, I think, or no, 1910, and you suddenly become King of Australia. Well, that would turn anybody's head, and his head was half turned anyway. So she didn't have a very happy marriage, and in effect, they drifted apart. So that I think then these two came together because they were of similar dispositions, I would guess.
And they also, they're politically rather similar, aren't they? Because they're both on the liberal, lib-lab sort of left, aren't they?
Really? I wouldn't have said Labour for Lady Denman, and I don't think really, probably not Labour for my mama, I would say.
It's liberal.
Liberal, I think. Mm. I think she'd have voted Labour rather than Conservative, yes, but I think Liberal would have been her first choice.
And anti-snobbish, anti-traditionalist, really? I mean,
anti-snobbish, anti-tradition, I think, would be too strong in the sense of being actually hostile to tradition,
yes.
No. Mm. But both of them, I think, would have respected tradition only insofar as it was still valuable. I mean, I can remember, for example, the coronation of 37, I suppose, Lady Denman, as a peeress, was entitled to go, didn't want to go, and let her robes to, I think, Lady Wavell or somebody like that. So she certainly hadn't any great use for the pomp of position. I'm a mile same, I think.
Yes. And you feel your mother was an eminently sort of, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but she was a sort of rational, reasonable person.
No, that's absolutely well agreed. Person. Absolutely agreed. And those are the words I would choose. Mm. In fact, I would have said she was, I still think she's the best organized, I remember saying to one of my friends, the best integrated person I knew. She seemed to me to be running like an engine most efficiently of anyone I knew. I mean, never getting overheated, never pinking, never breaking down. Just, and it would be totally wrong to suppose that she was in any sense emotionally flat, not a bit. I mean, she got tremendous pleasure out of almost everything she did. And there was no sort of desiccated calculating machine about it, just that she, it seemed to me that she ran life as efficiently as you can run it.
And as far as religion was concerned?
None. Brought up, I should imagine, in a conventional, perhaps Presbyterian. Her father was a Scotsman, but anyhow, God, am I right about that? Her mother was Scots. Father's family came from Devon. I think I'm wrong about that. Anyhow, I would have thought probably there was a vague Anglican background, which I would guess faded away at Oxford. And there was certainly not, had religion had no meaning for her. And she directed that she shouldn't be, there should be no religious ceremony concerned with her death.
And if anything, her birth control activities would push her against some types of religion.
Well, I think not against religion so much as against the church. I think she was opposed to the Roman Catholic Church's attitude, which in those days was very, very much more hostile than it is now. On the practical, if you like, political grounds, that it was opposing something which was, she thought, and I do too, desperately needed. And I think, therefore, she was against them practically and also against hypocrisy, which there was a lot of, you see.
Yes.
I mean, you know, what she couldn't abide was churchmen, and this applied to the Church of England, really, until the Lambeth Conference of, 58 or something, saying, oh, well, they must, other than ignoring the problem, or saying that, well, married couples must abstain when they were poor and they had five children, and it was just, that was just, I think she'd have thought, as I do, that's a wicked thing to say, really.
I think you also said that she was a sort of classless person, really.
I would have thought that's true. You know, that's, most people who make remarks, I guess, can be shown not to be telling the truth, but I sort of thought it was as near true to her, of her as anybody, yes. I mean, she did, in fact, meet a lot of titled people through Lady Denham and had lots and lots of friends who were anything but. So that I would have thought it really didn't matter.
And she could move from the one sphere to the other.
I would have thought with no trouble at all, yes. Doesn't mean to say she wasn't more comfortable in a big and comfortable house than a little cottage, but who isn't?
Mm. So for her day, you'd say remarkably unself-conscious about class.
Yes,
really.
I would.
Yes, yes. And presumably there's an element of sort of compassion for the underprivileged in the whole of this birth control business once she got involved in it.
Yes.
As well.
I think she wouldn't have used the word compassion, but I think that does in fact sum it up.
Mm.
I think
concern.
A concern and an urge to do good, although that sounds awfully breathy, but
yes.
That's really what it is.
Yes.
And not to do good in the sense of political reform, I think, but definitely something practical.
And this was really the only cause she had, apart from that and the work she did in the Second World War, which didn't take up any other sort of causes.
I don't think so in any major way. Well, I mean, she governed a school, but that's not a cause, is it? That was just something that appealed to her. And I can't remember the name of the school, but it's come to me a moment. What's the name of the church in Holborn?
Oh, St. Albans.
No, sorry, in Aldwich, the RAF Church. What's that called? Doesn't matter, but that's given the name of the school. That's a side point. That job appealed to her very much, and I think she probably did extremely well. And funnily enough, the Harvian librarian of this college, Dr. Charles Newman, was a co-governor of hers of the school, which is at Hammersmith, and had a great regard for her. And there was a time when the headmaster there was in big trouble from a secretary or second master, who was obviously a crook of some kind, and she clearly helped a lot. But that's not a cause in the sense of your meaning.
No, I see.
I didn't think there was anything else.
And she really can switch off and relax quite easily.
Oh, yes, very much so.
With golf.
Oh, yes, that's right. She wasn't the sort of person who was ferreting around or worrying about things. She would be happy and throw herself in, like playing bridge, like in crossword puzzles, liked company. Whatever was going, she'd be in there, as it were.
And could defuse situations, could she, by mentioning the latest sort of cricket match results?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's right. We'd have an executive committee and she'd have the test score. She got interested in cricket later. Had the test score brought in. I mean, if anyone could defuse a situation in a committee or a meeting, she could. Not always possible, but in the sense of being calm and intelligent, I think intelligence and balance. I think it's worth making sure she really wasn't an intelligent woman. Very, so that it was difficult to get around her, and she was virtually never angry, except with her sister.
You mean, when you say intelligent, you mean quick
to grasp, yes, that's right, yeah. Quick to grasp point. Not an intellectual, as I said last time. I mean, I think her interests were, her mental interests were fairly practical ones. I wouldn't think she'd have been interested in reading about philosophy, for example. But nevertheless, was quick to pick up an idea and see its implications.
And that leads really to the second level of her contribution to the FP, namely as chairman or president.
Yes, she became chairman. She was never a president. The president was a distinguished doctor, Lord Horder, until his death in 1953-54, and then Russell Brain after that, and he died a few months after she did. But that was, well, it was a very important role, but that's not what you're asking me about. No, she became chairman when Lady Denman died in 1954, until her own death in 1966, although she was, I think, going to give it up probably the next year.
And what? So, and can you just sort of paint a picture of her as chairman? I mean, how she coped?
Well, I think she was a marvellous chairman. She had to be chairman of the executive committee, which was about 20 or 30 people, and that could be quite difficult, but she also had to be chairman of the annual meeting, which would last about a day and a half, which was usually held in London, but was twice, I think, held outside London. And that would be 300, 400, 500 people, Church House, Westminster, usually. And as they were mostly not just listening to lectures, I think, but discussing serious issues, oh, about clinic organisation, whether birth control should be made available to the unmarried, which was a very hot issue in those days, and things like that. There was a goodish bit of controversy sometimes in those meetings, and quite a lot of procedural danger, resolutions, amendments, and this sort of thing. And I would have thought a lot of people could have gotten in trouble, and she virtually never did. I remember one meeting at Harrogate, which she chaired superbly, and when somebody did raise a point of order, when we'd gone on to the next business, she stopped and thought quite calmly for a bit, and then said, I think we had better go back. We were breaking the rules, but obviously, in the situation, that was the right thing to do. And I was full of admiration for that, and for chairmanship generally, because it's so easy, isn't it, to get people resentful and saying we're wasting time, or just getting aggressive. And in this movement, although I've talked about the later part being a smooth-running organisation, indeed it was, but there were some very strong-minded people still in it. I mean, it did tend to attract, you see, people who weren't just tea and coffee party and charity type at all, but both medical and non-medical, who really were determined to get on with a good job. Well, that was super, but they were also quite tough women, some of them, and men, but mostly women.
Yes, that's splendid. I wondered whether you could generalise at all about her attitude to doctors, really.
I think she liked them, and I think she generally respected them, but in committees, I don't think she did have a very high regard for them, and I saw then, and have certainly seen since, how you could take that view, because some of the women doctors who were the backbone of the FPA, Margaret Jackson, Helen Wright, Margaret Jackson perhaps particularly, super person, done superb work and really delightful, but in committee was both attempted to be autocratic in the way that I think she ran her clinic, which must have been irritating for her colleagues there, but nevertheless she did a marvellous job, and also illogical, inconsistent, with no idea of how to proceed or how to conduct business.
The latter I find puzzling. I mean, surely a doctor has to be logical and consistent, doesn't he? I mean, why should they behave differently in a committee in that respect? I can see very much the first of your points.
Yes.
But why the second?
Well, I think it's a common failing of doctors then and now that they don't really, it's very odd, I don't know why, but they don't really see how things have to be done taken in order that, well, this is not true of all of them, some of them very good politicians, that you can't change your opinion every item on the agenda or every time you have a meeting. I don't know why it should be. Maybe they're too used to having their word go. And I dare say if you analyse their clinical decisions, you'd find that they were often illogical. They treat one patient's condition this way and the next patient's things in a different way.
It's very interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought, because there is an obvious contradiction, isn't there, between the almost authoritarian situation they're in their day-to-day life and working in a committee, which is the...
That's right. And I would say that doctors are probably some of the worst committee men and ergo the worst politicians in general. I would have thought of any of the profession.
It's very interesting, presumably maybe even more so then than would be the case.
Right, because they're not, they're under much more attack now and so on.
You feel your mother was always pressing forward in the birth control?
Yes, that's very much so, yes, always. I
mean, not content at any stage with where they'd got.
Absolutely right, and whenever any issue came up, she'd always be on the sort of forward moving. And for example, this issue of birth control for the unmarried, you see, which was a red hot issue. She was always for not sort of sitting down outside the House of Parliament or anything like that, but we must just move as fast as we can in this direction, realizing perfectly well what the body of opinion in the FPA was. A lot of people in the FPA, you see, were hotly opposed to that. And she and Russell Brain, to his credit, realized that we were going to have to move this way. But nevertheless, in the process of doing it, she would lose the minimum support and the minimum number of friends. But she was quite strong and firm by it.
And this would be done without any self-advertisement, presumably. I mean, she knew when to retreat and retire and not to show herself.
I think, really, there was no self-advertisement about her. I think she was... she certainly liked affection and respect. I don't think she'd ever have functioned well in an environment where toughness and hostility were abounding. That wouldn't have been how she'd have come to deliver her best product, I'm sure. I remember one thing talked about with Lady Denman, actually, both said, she and I, that we did depend rather on being on rapport. Well, really, what I really mean is being liked by the people we're with. And Lady Denman had a greater integrity, really. She didn't mind nearly so much. Maybe this came from the self-assurance of her position, I don't know. But I think both my mom and I realized that this was a potential weakness. I think it was, but I don't think it... I don't remember it leading to anything.
No, weak. And anyway, the problems were over. In a sense, the major problems of that sort were over by the...
The major ones 30. Were, but I wouldn't underplay the little prima donna around. You see, so if you think in the 1930s and 1940s, and you started a clinic in Oxford, Audrey Hobson, for example, who was the wife of, God, I can't remember his first name, Fred Hobson, the Radcliffe, you see, who died only about 15, 18 years ago. You know, but when you were starting it, and there was still a lot of opposition in Oxford, hell of a lot, this is well before the war, you had to be fairly tough, because it wasn't sitting in an office in London. You had to go down to Aldgate, or where it was, and start a clinic and go there every Tuesday. And you might have nasty remarks in the local paper. You might have people outside the book. So by definition, you and the doctors working there had to be quite tough. So
but also, it's not a pleasant, easy thing to talk about in social life.
Absolutely. Certainly not. I mean, it's gone 180 degrees since then.
Absolutely rather too far.
Well, that would be my personal thing too, but the difference is absolutely chalked cheese.
And of course, with somebody like Maurice Topes, in a way, they respond by rather glorying in shocking people.
Oh, very much so. Oh, yes, she was an exhibitionist.
Whereas, of course, the quality required in these early days is the reverse. Well, in the earliest days is the reverse of that, in a way.
Yes.
Did your mother have any view of Maurice Topes? Do you remember her?
Oh, yes. I think she thought she was impossible. I mean, they tried to work with her, and I'd forgotten, but I think you told me last time that they did, in fact. She did stay in the FPA for a year or two. I didn't realize...
Till 1933.
Well, I didn't realize it as long as that. Then she sort of took herself off. Oh, no, she thought she was quite impossible to work with. I think she admired what she'd done. I think she thought she was a self-dramatist and an exhibitionist and and a prima donna. It was just not possible to work with her except in an entire subordinate capacity. And my bet is that that is true. I heard her speak at any rate once and heard about her, and she was constantly striking poses. She wasn't a medical doctor, as you know. She was a PhD in coal chemistry. That may not be relevant, but I mean, she was not posing. I don't think she was doing that, but taking the role of medical doctor, she would decide what sort of methods and so on, and was terribly emotional about everything. I think it was dead right that she got out. And also, I think most of the medical people thought her methods were pretty suspect.
The last thing I want to ask you was simply about the relationship between the medical world and the whole world of birth control. You were rather interesting about that. I mean, you were saying, I think last time, that in a sense, a few key people like Lord Horder take the lead at the top.
Yes.
In the 1950s, is this?
1930. He became the first.
Even in the 30s.
That's right.
And in a sense, they helped to make it acceptable to the medical profession generally. It certainly wasn't working up from below, anyway.
No. The curious thing is, I think that the people at the top, medically, whom you have to give credit to, are Dawson of Penn, who, when the King's physician, had, I've forgotten what, but about 1928, he had spoken out in favour of birth control and got a slashing leader in the Daily Mail, I think. Quite offensive, which wasn't, you know, if you're the King's physician, you have nothing to gain and everything to lose by saying it. So I think great credit to him. Then Lord Horder, who was also the King's physician after Dawson's death, I think. Do I mean that? Can't quite remember. Anyhow, certainly he was the top physician. Became the president till he died in 54. And then Russell Brain, who was at that time president of this college, who died in 56. And then Lord Florey, president of the Royal Society, I think. And then Lord Platt, president of this college, if I remember correctly. In other words, you had that sort of strand at the very, very top, giving investing it with medical respectability. But I must admit, there was then an enormous gap. Until you came to the people like Helen Wright and others who were doing the work all right and were really pioneers but were not highly regarded by the medical profession. There were one or two, Will Nixon at UCH, for example, who was professor of obstetrics there, who came in, and Lane Roberts, who was a well-known gynecologist at Guy's. There were a few of these people before and just after the war who bravely came in, and gradually the middle was filled in. And now, of course, the whole picture is complete. But in the first place, these chaps like Horder and Dawson were very brave.
Why should it actually work that way? Why should these people? Is it just individual quirks, do you think?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. The only thing I can think of is that you only had to get one man to do that, whereas to fill in the middle, as it were, and make it medically respectable, you had to get a swing of opinion amongst thousands of men. So, for example, Russell Brain, who became president in 54, when admittedly things were moving, but it was still under the line, as it were, was a Quaker and a high-minded chap, and I think he felt it was right to do this. Why Horder did it, I don't know, but it was jolly brave of him, I think.
And then the last brave person was Ian MacLeod, you felt, as a politician.
I think he was terrific, yes. Because until he visited the FPA, went to North Kensington Clinic, and came to the FPA headquarters and had a lunch, I think, and met people, he certainly met people in the clinic, and made a little speech, which was reported in the papers, no sort of minister had come anywhere near the place. And he was invited to come really through Lady Monckton, who I remember when talking to my mum, I said, well, why didn't you ask Ian MacLeod? I know him well, I'll ask him for you. So they did. All such invitations before having been, of course, absolutely refused by ministers and leaders. He came, he said, make whatever use you like of it. You can put out the statement, you can take photographs. He posed outside the building. Unheard of. No idea. Unheard of. And suddenly the dam broke. It was really astonishing. It broke in weeks, really. My mum then followed it up, went to the Times, who said, yes, we have really been, as it were, blacking you. I've forgotten the name of the chap who was, she saw there, maybe the assistant editor who was a Catholic, and said, and they made good, had leading articles, and BBC Ditto, and she went on BBC and went on Panorama, and in a few weeks, months, the thing was being mentioned. And as a sort of indicator of the media block, if there was any mention of the FPA, birth control and family planning, before about that time, certainly several years before, even a little thing in the Daily Mirror or something, there'd be 5,000 letters the next week at the FPA, which in those days, Eccleston Square had about one room this size. So absolute floods of people writing and sending. And then soon after this, you see, within a few years of the Ian MacLeod visit, it was being mentioned in the press all the time, and if you mentioned the FPA, well, nothing happened because everyone knew about it. It wasn't the revelation that it had been. And I'm sure that this was an indication of the destruction of the media barrier.
Mm. And you feel at the end of her life, your mother was, without being complacent, happy at the way things worked out.
Yeah. I think her attitude probably would have been, well, that was a jolly good job. Well done. I'm glad I did it, and I enjoyed every minute of it. That would be my guess how she'd sum it up. And she didn't know what to do. I mean, I was on the executive committee. So I saw a lot of the FPA from about 1951, I should think, and started the journal. Because in those days, they couldn't fill executive, people recruited, and that, later on, there was great competition. But anyhow, we talked about the FPFS a lot, obviously. And she would say, well, now, there's a difficult situation. What do you think I ought to do? And I would say, well, what do you think you should do? And she'd say, well, I think I ought to do ABC. And I would say, well, that's an excellent idea. That's exactly what I think you ought to do. What good judgment you have, she would say. But she didn't realize how funny it was, you see. I would then tease her with this and say, all I do is to parrot back what you say to me.
I forgot to ask you about how you became a doctor. It was entirely your own choice, but it did please her nonetheless.
I would think very much, yes. It was a rather gradual decision. I started after school certificate at low levels doing physics, chemistry, and math, and then after about 6 weeks dropped the math and did biology. I think then gradually thinking that I'd do medicine in the next few months, that sort of solidified. And I would have thought it was, though she would never have pushed me that way, I think she was very, very pleased, partly because she thought it was a worthwhile job and partly because her father had been.
Did you actually move into family planning sort of entirely voluntarily as well?
I'm not a family planning doctor at all.
Yes.
My interest in medicine is quite...
How did you get on the executive committee? Was it just a doctor?
Well, at that time they were short of people.
Mm.
I was her son.
Yes, I see.
Really. Mm. I never felt myself as a doctor there, although obviously it gave one some advantage and one would criticise. I would criticise my medical colleagues when they were behaving impossibly or making stupid assessments or remarks, as I thought. And I always felt myself to be a layman, really, there. As it were, an informed layman. And I've never done that sort of medicine. You know, I'm not a gynecologist and I'm not especially interested in those problems.
Mm.
Background. The kind of medicine I do is different. Mm. But I really got on as her son, and then I edited the magazine.
And then you got sort of involved more?
Got involved and was re-elected, but not always. I mean, there was certainly one year when I can't remember, I had to be co-opted because I had tied with somebody else. And then later on, much later on, I wasn't. And I was kicked off, or wasn't elected when the constitution was, which didn't matter, and I think it was quite right.
Mm. Yeah.
And then I dropped out of it.
Yes, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think.